We'll bring House Cyber and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:26 p.m., April 3rd, 2006. We have a quorum, members present, Representative Cott, Guttenberg, Rokeberg, and myself, Chairman Anderson. Other members eminent presence. We have postponed HB 494, I'm told. So Senate Bill 298, Trust Challenges, Claims, Liabilities, and House Bill 480, which was scheduled for Friday, and Representative Ledoux asked that we hold it till today. Based on pre-meeting discussions, I think that we'll just have the testimony on that and then hold the bill over so the advocacy for that bill can talk to members outside of the committee deliberations. So we'll go first to Senate Bill 298. We have Senator Seekins here. Welcome to House Finance.
Mr. Chairman, with the recent skits in mind, I hope you understand that your appearance in a skit having to do with the Senate Judiciary Committee was not with my prior approval.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
He's not wearing a hat, nor is he Southern enough.
We have invited Senator Cowdery to come to the meeting.
Did you? Should I go get him?
No one gets that joke. Welcome.
Do you have any ice water or mint jewel? No, on the serious side, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. This Senate Bill 298 is another one of the improvements that we are putting into our trust system in the state of Alaska. As you may know, Alaska right now is one of the leading venues for trusts in the United States, primarily due to the efforts of some very bright people who are in the trust business, lawyers, accountants, trust attorneys, and we work with them on a regular basis to make sure that we stay the leading venue in terms of the simplicity which we can manage trust without sacrificing any protections for the beneficiaries of the trust. And since 1997, the Alaska State Legislature has consistently work with these folks to update and improve our laws regarding the use and administration of trusts. And as a result, you know, we are considered one of the leaders, but there are other states, there are seven others right now, Delaware, Missouri, Nevada, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, South Dakota, and Utah have all enacted similar legislation to ours, trying to take that business away from the state. The updates in this bill that you have before you, and I have people who can give you specifics on the updates and the effect of those updates, are in keeping with the revisions that we made to the trust laws in 1997 and again in 2003. They're intended to help us to preserve our leading position within the universe of trust providers and services that are offered nationwide. And our laws encourage Alaskans to keep their trust assets here in the state, and moreover, capital is attracted to Alaska from all over the country, creating greater job and investment opportunities for residents of our state, other benefits such as premium taxes, et cetera, that come to our treasury. So this bill, Senate Bill 298, clarifies prior trust legislation and makes the administration of trusts in Alaska more efficient, more cost-effective, and it will help us to keep Alaska as the jurisdiction of choice for trust administration. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions. However, the folks that follow me are going to be able to do so with much greater clarity
I can. Senator Seekins, thank you. I think this is a timely bill. We do have one of the best constructs for trust law in the nation, and that evolution has been occurring. I think probably as I've talked to Doug and Dick and Paul and some others, it's probably every 2 years going to have to be updated. And I appreciate that you have done this and taken hold of it. I see we have five folks online that are, I believe, supportive. Everyone online is supportive, except we just had a call in from a Mark Ames from Fairbanks. I'm going to allow everyone 3 minutes, only 3 minutes. Mark, that's you two, and I'm going to let you go first, and then we'll get to the five endorsers and close and move the bill out. So Mark Ames from Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I just flagged the card rooms.
Mark, are you there?
It's not as big a gamble here, Miss.
And Representative Ledoux has joined us. Mark Ames, are you there from Fairbanks?
Yes.
Was that a yes?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I sure can. I'll give you 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, first I'd like to, in association with this bill, point out that there's an associated public interest I will invoke for adjoinment in this testimony by stating the 6 published goals of Alaska State Historic Preservation Plan, public interest findings, points out in part to make connections between economic and historic preservation, the awareness and value of and importance of Alaska's historic resources. I'm wanting to point out, as a claimant of interest, with regard to the May 1st, 1968 trust, with regard to the state of Alaska, laws of Alaska 1972 and Act, Chapter 54, Source SCSHB 38, Section 1, Purpose, Purposeful Terms, an act regarding the Alaska 67 site. Of course, that's located on the mainland here in the interior in the city of Fairbanks. The Alaska 1967 Centennial Commemorative Landmark Public Park site, of course, having only one other corresponding site at our one-time offshore southeast capital city of Newark, Angel Island, Sitka, Alaska, today the city and borough of Sitka, the 1867 site. Getting back to the laws of Alaska in 1972, as aforementioned, effective May 16th, 72, Section 1, purpose by the terms of Chapter 15, FSSLA 1967. There are those premises within the city of Fairbanks that a trust with regard to the state of Alaska regarding Federal Reserve lands has been abused and violated. I'm trying to find out. I don't see where there's a lot of protection in the HB 298 with regard to this.
And Mark, you have 30 seconds. I appreciate your thoughtful testimony. 30 seconds left, my friend.
Okay, I want to point out that I'm a claimant. I ask for official investigation to the full and clear title to the premises described in the deed of trust dated May 1st, 1968, which were not to be sold, said property for a period of 50 years. I'm claiming that there is a violation against the Constitution's inherent rights, Section 1 and Section 2, Section 1 and then our Natural Resources Article 8. I'm a claimant, a public interest claimant to this, and I ask that we investigate, as I understand it, the deed of trust in association with the state is absolutely missing. And so as a beneficiary, as an intended beneficiary, I'd like to have that noted, and I want to thank Mr. Seekins for his work. But this is in your backyard, sir, and we need to make sure all our trusts that we've already committed ourselves to are not being abused, violated, which they are.
Okay. And, Mark, I appreciate that. And I see in the audience press, Bob Takach is here. After the meeting, I'll make sure that my staff gives you his number to call because I'm sure he's interested in this. I see him typing and in case there's more stories. So, good. We'll go next to Beth Chapman in the audience.
Sorry, Bob.
Hi, Beth.
Hi. My name is Beth Chapman, and I'm from Juneau. And thank you, Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in support of SB 298. I have been practicing law in Juneau for the last 18 years, working in the trust and estates area. And I represent individual families as well as trustees and trust beneficiaries. And I believe that SB 298 is a very important piece of legislation because it will give us the tools to more efficiently and effectively assist our clients in achieving their family's goals, particularly their estate planning goals. In particular, it will help reduce costs of administration and aligns the trust laws with the probate laws, which in the past have been very disconnected and in many times have related caused expenses to be incurred, which now can be avoided because we'll have clear laws. Most importantly, I'd like to speak to sections 2 and 3 regarding a trustee's power to appoint trust assets in another trust for the benefit of the trust beneficiaries. This is very important because as trusts last longer and longer, we have families who need to respond to changes in the circumstances of their families, whether a child becomes disabled, has drug and alcohol problems, or is simply too immature to receive trust assets. This will allow a trustee to continue to hold assets in trust on the same standards, so the trust beneficiaries are protected, but can do so without court approval and thereby keeping litigation costs down. The second provision deals with the statute of limitations. Currently, we have 3 statute of limitations for claims against a trustee. That leads to confusion and increased litigation. This would reduce that to 1 statute of limitations for all reports, so long as the beneficiaries are notified by the trustees of the length of that statute of limitations and what they will need to do to assert their claims. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee will have.
Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. Some questions regarding Section 2, and I think you went right to it. The difference between changing the language from authority to absolute discretion to authority, and same thing from discretion to authority. What does that do? How does this? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Is there somebody from the agency or from the trust, or is Ms. Chapman the right person to?
I think.
Asking these questions.
Do you think you can answer
yes,
this?
Yes, I can answer the questions. Representative Guttenberg, the change was because under the current law, only a trustee who has absolute authority, which means there's no standard by which they exercise their discretion to invade the principle of a trust, could use the statute to create a new trust for the benefit of the beneficiary. This change allows a trustee who would have a standard, a typical standard in a trust says, you can invade this for the beneficiary's health or education. This, if the trust has that standard under this new provision, they would still be able to create a new trust and for the beneficiary, keeping it in trust longer, so long as they maintain that same standard. So it broadens the scope of the provision and allows it to be used by more trustees.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg, follow-up?
We can always bring Mr. Ames back if you... not being a lawyer, on line 10 of page 2, the same section, what does intervisios mean? Visos? Line 10.
Inter vivos?
Yeah, what is that?
It means during life.
Okay.
Can also be cured with penicillin.
It means the interim.
Okay, any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you. We'll go next to Doug. Doug.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. My name is Douglas Blotmacher, and I'm President and CEO of Alaska Trust Company. And I support HB 298. I believe it'll modernize our trust laws and keep us competitive. And
great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Brookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Blotmacher, on Section 7 of the bill on page 3, as the prior witness just indicated, there seems to be an extension of the or a diminution of the statute of limitations in which a beneficiary can commence a claim. It looks like it goes from 24 months down to 6 months. Is this particular revision due to a competitive nature of the business or is it a policy call regarding the adequacy of a statute of limitation policy?
It's both. A lot of the professional community felt that we had too many different timelines and they wanted to make them more consistent and felt that by reducing it to 6 months and then having a bold print, it would cause the beneficiary to have more of a urgency about taking some action if they felt that there was a problem.
Representative Guttenberg?
And in Section 6, gives the time for this, to have a claim from, reduces it from 90 to 60 days.
That's to be consistent with the probate code.
Okay, is that what we're doing here in the
yes.
next section, also from down to 45 days? Okay.
Okay, Representative Roper?
Just going back to the Section 100. So the statute of limitations is from a point of notification to the beneficiary that they need to assert a claim?
Yes.
So they've already been notified, and is that judicial notification? So there is a service, so there's an acknowledgement of receipt, or?
You want to defer that to Dick Thwaites?
I'll defer that to one of the other parties. I don't know the technical answer to that one.
Okay.
But they have to be notified. I don't know if it has to be a judicial notification.
Well, it's at least notification.
Right.
There's some acknowledgement.
Yes.
So, but that seems, because that's a significant difference from 24 months to 6 months. So.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll check on that. See, no other questions. Thank you. Doug, well, let's go to Mitchell Gans, law professor, Hospital University, then David Schaftel, then Dick Thwaites, wrap-up.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Am I on?
Yeah, Mitchell.
This is Mitchell Gans,
yep,
of Hofstra University Law School in New York. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for giving me an opportunity to address you today. Let me just pick up on what Doug was talking about and respond to the question that was on the table about the policy issue and the competitive issue in terms of the statute of limitations. I at some point had been consulted about a matter, and we looked at the question of the statute of limitations, and we found that Florida had a six-month statute of limitations similar to the one you have before you, and as a result, these people decided to use Florida law instead of Alaska law. We then had a chance to take a look at the question more broadly, and from a policy perspective, it seemed to me that it was more appropriate to shorten up the statute of limitations rather than to allow it to remain longer. Here's essentially the policy argument. If a trustee wants to shorten up their liability, the time frame for being liable, they can do so by commencing a judicial accounting. That, of course, involves an expense, and that expense, of course, is going to be borne by the beneficiaries of the trust. So you wind up with, I think, an inefficiency. You wind up, in the case of trustees who want to shorten it up, they can do so simply by putting the cost on, by incurring the cost, and then, of course, putting it on the trust beneficiaries. And it seems to me that that's an inefficiency. It also seems to me inequitable that, you know, in the case of a judicial accounting, you can get a much shorter statute, and in the case of an informal accounting, you have a much longer statute, and I don't think there's a good reason for that kind of discrimination. And then, of course, finally, you have the point that Mr. Blotmacher referenced, and that is that with the short statute of limitations of 6 months, the shorter statute, you, of course, require, or it results in the beneficiary being required to focus very carefully on their rights rather than their being lulled into a sense of, oh, I have a long time within which to decide what to do about this, sitting back and as I say, lulled into a sense of I'll put it off and procrastination, and they wind up with their rights being taken away by the statute. So I think for all of those reasons, it seems to me to be a very good idea to follow the pattern that Florida is setting. I think we're going to see it throughout the country. I think it's going to move throughout the country, and I think it's wise to do it.
Okay, thank you, Professor. Seeing no questions, we'll go next to Dave.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson and members of House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm an estate planning attorney here in Anchorage. I've been practicing in Alaska since, I guess, 1970. I'm a member of this informal group of attorneys and trust officers and financial advisors who have been working with the legislature really since 1997, Senator Seekins described, to help improve Alaska's trust and estate statutes. I participated in drafting several of the provisions that are in House Bill or Senate Bill 298, and I think these are very helpful provisions for both the residents of Alaska, who are primarily my clients, and I see these kinds of issues and problems develop routinely, and the provisions we're adding here are designed to improve the process of trust administration and solve some of those problems. It's also, these provisions should be helpful to non-residents of Alaska who are using some of Alaska's laws for their own estate planning. So I think it's an excellent bill. On the subject you've just been discussing, just to add one point, the Uniform Probate Code similarly provides for a process that involves a statute of limitations of approximately 6 months. So the amendments that you're considering here will also be consistent with that uniform law. So I support this bill, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Good. Thank you, David. Question from Representative Roseberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schaftel, could you explain to the committee what kind of impact this has had on your business and the Alaska Trust business in general?
Well, for Representative Roseberg, yes. But I have seen since we've been, for example, the community property system, the optional community property system, which the legislature has enacted, the ability to extend trust duration for as long as the trusts have assets, the ability to create trusts that will be able to allow Alaska residents to save considerable estate taxes and allow other non-residents to use those kinds of trusts. Those have just been very, very beneficial to my clients. We sit down here, routinely we use all of those benefits that I've just described for all of our clients. Our clients in our practice here in Anchorage are medium to large estates, and these are clients who've lived here in Anchorage for a long time, and they're very appreciative of being able to do this kind of planning. So it's been a great benefit, and indirectly I'm talking with trust officers with the banks. There are now four institutions here in Anchorage which provide trustee services for these kinds of trusts, and I know that there's been a very substantial use of these vehicles, and many people from outside of Alaska are using our financial resources, which can only be good for Alaska in terms of developing our state as a financial center, as other small states, for example, South Dakota and Delaware, they have done this, and much to their advantage, and I think we're on the way of developing a very strong financial industry here.
Okay, thank you. We'll go next to Dick Thwaites. He's the last person to testify.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson. My name is Dick Thwaites. I am speaking both as a private practitioner and as chairman of the Alaska Trust Company. In both capacities, I support Senate Bill 298, as is before the committee here, and would be most willing to answer any questions or amplify anything that's been done in any of the questions that have been asked thus far.
I'll just disclaim that McGuire and I use Dick for our large estate planning.
Who?
My wife. Oh. Representative Roseberg.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thwaites, says the chairman of the Alaska Trust Company, could you answer the question I asked to Mr. Schaftel in terms of the impact and scope in your business and what that's meant to the state of Alaska in terms of economic impact and actually even the state treasury in terms of jumbo insurance premiums?
Yes, Representative Roper, through the chair. As a private practitioner, I've had lots of clients use the provisions that we have done, particularly the one Mr. Schaftel referred to, the Optional Community Property Act. I've had some clients in the Valley that had homestead property with a very low basis. One spouse had passed away, thus giving a step-up in tax basis to the surviving spouse in all of the property, resulting in well over $1 million in savings of estate tax that the children would have otherwise had to have paid. And also a considerable savings on the income tax side between the death of the mother and the father. On the side as chairman of the trust company, I think we've had probably as many as 1,000 trusts or more just for this one company. Of that, I would say probably 10% are Alaskan, and the majority come from outside of the state of Alaska. In that process, and tracking only those clients, I can attribute at least $2 million that have gone directly to the state treasury through the increased premium tax. There have been other taxes and other benefits by the fact that we have 9 or 10 employees with the trust company, and of those, 5 have been born and raised in Alaska and produced some fairly decent salaries to those people. They aren't low-end wages, and I think the state has benefited that way as well.
Any other questions for Mr. Thwaites? Anybody else wishing to testify? Representative Bentenberg.
Thank you. You know, since we've implemented this concept of trust in Alaska, it seems like we constantly are come back in and tweaking it in order to stay ahead of the wave. I'm just wondering if it's from your impression that we're able to stay there because this body is able to work faster than other states and be more proactive.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, yes, that's true. I think that the legislature has developed a very good rapport with those practitioners in the state in this area. I can tell you, though, that Delaware was able to, while it took us from probably 1993 or 94 until 97 to get the first legislation through, it only took Delaware 16 weeks from the passage of our act to an act that tended to mimic the Alaska Act. And even in the last couple of sentences of that act, it said this act is intended to copy the Alaska statutes recently enacted to keep Delaware the number one in trusts, and that's in their actual legislation. They, in fact, didn't quite copy us and missed a couple of provisions that the IRS thought were fairly critical, so that has given us the chance to stay pretty much ahead of the rest of the states. And clearly, the legislature in Juneau has facilitated that with their willingness to listen to these modifications as we go through.
No other questions? Anyone in the audience? Anyone else online? Then we'll close public testimony. Hello? We'll close public testimony. And is there any debate or discussion before we move the bill out of committee? Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to hear the response from Mr. Thwaites regarding the $2 million in premium tax insurance receipts that the states received. And I'd like to remind the committee the reason that occurred was that we have the insurance premium tax whereby particularly large, what's called jumbo life insurance policies are written for trusts. And what the legislature did as a matter of policy is limit the amount of the insurance premium, which is quite substantial on very large policies, to enhance the business up here. So in other words, Mr. Chairman, my point is what the legislature did was limit the tax on an industry and increased investment in the state. It's a good exercise that we should keep in mind.
I agree. Representative Roekberg, seeing no other comments, do you want to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 298 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note or notes.
Okay, hearing no objections, so moved.
Right.
Okay, we'll go next to... here's just the laugh. We'll go next to House Bill 480, which I think I'm going to hold after we have public testimony. Again, I noted that as the meeting started because I think there may be some questions that we'll need to work out outside of the committee process. Heath Hilliard's here with my office to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Heath Hilliard. I'm staff to Representative Anderson. I have before you today HB 480. Before I begin my presentation, Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out that there is a blank committee substitute that essentially all of our presentation materials will speak to, and I wanted to point that out if you wanted to adopt
it. Well, I'd like to move
that
for discussion purposes that we adopt version Y of House Bill 480. Hearing no objection, House Bill 480 version Y is in yellow is before us for discussion purposes.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair. You have before you HB 480, which is an act relating to voluntary self-evaluative audits by insurance providers. Most basically what this bill does is it emulates law that's currently in place in 8 different states that allows insurance companies to voluntarily conduct self-evaluative audits to determine whether or not their practices and procedures are in concert with all applicable state statute and insurance regulations in this state. And that is the very basic essence of what this bill does. When this bill was brought before us or brought to us prior to drafting, we were taking we were using essentially a model act that had been, I believe, adopted in Illinois as our basis. And during the course of deliberations between the Division of Insurance and those that brought this forward, there were about 4 or 5 different iterations of this bill. One of the things you'll note between the sponsor statement in terms of the title and also what you have before you in version Y is that this current version does not appear to require amendment to the rules, Alaska rules of court and evidentiary rules. So this is a much more scaled back version.
Heath, I'm going to have to interrupt while Brian's here. I'm going to have to go off record real quick to check on something. So, okay, we are reconvening House Labor and Commerce. Heath Hilliard was in the middle of presenting House Bill 480 version Y, as in yellow, and I've interrupted him to readdress House Bill 298, pardon me, Senate Bill 298, because we made a motion, Representative Roekberg made a motion to move that bill out of committee, but there was not a reference to what version was moved out of committee. And Brian from Senator Seekin's office has stated that we need to move version S as in Sam out of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we
rescind
our action in adopting committee substitute for Senate Bill 298, the judiciary version, that being the I version.
Okay.
And
is there any objection to rescinding that? The erroneous bill that we tried to move out. Okay, so that's been rescinded.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the House Committee substitute for the Committee substitute for Senate Bill 298-24-LS-1113/S-331-06 as our working
backslash
document.
S version, as yes. In Sam. Okay. Yes. Yes. Hearing no objection, that bill is before us.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
Yeah, we have the sponsors, staff here. Is there a brief explanation of the differences in the CSs?
For the record, Brian Hove, staff for Senator Seekins, through the chair, Representative Roekberg. Page 2, line 20. One of the, I think it was Ms. Chapman that caught this. Beneficiary should have been plural, beneficiaries. That's the only change.
No bill?
Jeez. Okay.
We aim to get it right, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so Representative Roper.
I move that we move House Bill, House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 298, S version from committee with individual recommendations and attached to our fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, so moved. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now we bring back before us House Bill 480, and Mr. Hilliard was in the process of explaining the impetus behind filing of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and back to 480. Anyway, to wrap up my very brief presentation, the bill you have before you, the version, the work draft that we are presenting, is an amalgamation of an ongoing conversation between Allstate Insurance, the Division of Legislative Legal, and the Division of Insurance. And I believe Mr. Jeffrey Trout from the Division of Insurance will be available also to speak to some of the division's thoughts and concerns through the development of this bill. But I do have here Mr. Sheldon Winters, who can testify in some detail about the policy background to this bill, and I'd be available for questions after he's done. So
okay, great. Shalom.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sheldon Winters. I represent State Farm Insurance Companies. I'd like to speak briefly to 3 points this afternoon. The first is to talk about the policy and support behind this legislation, because that's essentially what your decision will boil down to. Secondly, I'll talk briefly about the bill itself and tell you what it is and what it isn't, because it's a very, very limited privilege. And lastly, I'll touch briefly on why this makes sense in Alaska. Our laws should encourage and protect those people who play by the rules. and those who actively look at themselves and try to determine whether or not they're following the rules. In today's society, that's not as simple as it used to be. Insurance companies that are interested in using proactive, voluntary self-evaluations are limited by the harsh reality that these evaluations may be turned against them inappropriately and used against them inappropriately. House Bill 480 addresses these concerns by providing a very limited protection for voluntary self-evaluations. Now, the concept of a privilege for self-evaluative, voluntary self-evaluative privileges has wide support throughout the country. With respect to corporations generally, virtually every legal writing and scholarly writing has supported the policy of a privilege. And I think there's a citation, a couple of citations in your sponsor statement, Harvard Law Review, William and Mary Law Review, and the Kansas Journal of Law and Public Policy. In a variety of settings, virtually every state has adopted one form or another of a self-evaluative privilege. Most states have privileges for environmental assessments. Companies that want to look and make sure they're compliant with environmental laws can do that and be protected. Most states have peer review privileges. And Alaska has both those. We have a statute that protects reviews of physicians, and we have a statute, a statutory scheme that protects environmental audits. And just so you folks know, I think this demonstrates that this sort of protection is truly bipartisan. The environmental law that was passed 32-4 in the House and 16-3 in the Senate. Now, with respect to the insurance industry, there is also broad support. Obviously, broad support from the industry. I can name all the acronyms, PCI, NAMIC, AIA, ACLI, et cetera. There's also support from the regulators. This bill is modeled on a model act from NCOIL, National Commission of Insurance Legislatures, although we've watered it down quite a bit. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, NAIC, also supports the policy of encouraging voluntary self-reviews. While its position is ultimately that that decision is for the legislature, it encourages each regulator in each state to encourage such self-reviews. That's real important in this state because our statutes incorporate a lot of the NAIC model laws regarding examinations and conduct of insurers. So here's an agency that this legislature has deferred to before, saying, and I quote, regulators should look for ways to incorporate appropriate recognition of such programs into ongoing regulatory oversight efforts. And they're talking about self-audits. This bill does that, which I'll explain in a second. Now, we've been working with the Division of Insurance for about a year now to get something that's acceptable to them, and we believe we've done that. We've started with the NCOIL model. We've taken out provisions, virtually every provision that they've been concerned about, and we think we have something that is actually is a very workable bill. Let me tell you what the bill is and isn't. By definition, it's limited. It applies only to an internal evaluation that is completely voluntary by the company, that's not otherwise required by law, and it must be specifically designed to identify problems and improve compliance with laws and regulations. Now, what does that mean? It does not apply to any assessment that a company has to do by law or is required to do by the regulator. It does not apply to any other pre-existing material, files, claims files, statistics, anything that's out there already. It just applies to the insurance company's decision to look at that data and evaluate it. Anything that's out there pre-existing is access to those records remains exactly as the same as it is today. But from a practical standpoint, I think the division actually gets more information. It does not create any sort of immunity from criminal or civil liability whatsoever. Plaintiffs can have their full day in court. They get access to every single document that they now get, except the internal review document that we want to generate. Lastly, and the beauty of this this particular privilege is that we've limited it from the NCOIL model, and the regulator, the Division of Insurance, still gets even the self-critical analysis document. They're not precluded from getting anything. And so now you have a situation by definition in this statute, they are getting a self-review that perhaps they would not have gotten otherwise. So that's, we think, is actually the beauty of this law, is that now it will not only encourage us to do this review, but encourage us to give it to the division. I want to be brief here, but I think I'll give a quick example of how this works, if I can, and that may shed some light on some things here. Let's say an insurance company wants to do a review in Alaska of, are we paying our property damage claims on autos properly in Alaska? So they decide to do this internal review, not requested by the division to do it, not required by the division to do it, but they decide this is a good thing to look at. Let's see if we're doing it right. So they find, they take 3,000 claims files in Alaska and start looking at them. And lo and behold, they find maybe in 20% of the claims they're making a mistake. They're not paying enough money. Maybe it's at a particular office that's interpreting the law incorrectly. So what do they do with that? Well, ideally, they go out and they fix it. They pay those claims. And with this law, they can then take that document and that review and go to the division and say, we made a mistake here, and here's what we did to fix this. The division at that point in time can say, okay, we're glad you did it, and write off on it. Or if the division thinks that there needs to be more punishment or more involvement and can't work that out with the insurer, the division is free to take on its own investigation, issue its own penalties, even though we are the ones that tipped off the division. So that's the beauty of it, is that we are going to the division and giving them information that they otherwise would not have. Now, let's say one of those claimants actually sues the insurance company. Is there any difference there? No, they're not. They still get their claims file. If they want to sue us for punitive damages, they still get to get the other 3,000 claims files and try to find out if this is some type of inherent policy we get. They get to do any assessment that they normally would do. They just don't get our own assessment of that. So it really boils down to the question of this. Should a voluntary self-evaluation where a company has taken upon itself to find out the problem and corrected that problem, should that be given some protection, or should we give that fair game to be used against us? That's really the nub of the policy question. So with this limited privilege, I just want to close by answering the question, why is it desirable in Alaska? Well, first, as stated above, it encourages self-correction. A regulatory environment that encourages voluntary self-correction is undoubtedly in the public's best interest, and that's written in all the articles, all the discussions, all the law review articles. Secondly, it actually enhances regulatory enforcement in three respects. First, because of limited resources, regulators are unable to address the breadth of all the potential problems out there. Self-evaluations don't cost the state anything. Department of Division of Insurance resources can be used on investigating other issues. Secondly, the privilege allows insurers the comfort of informing the division of corrected conduct, thereby putting the division on notice of the conduct that otherwise wouldn't have, which I talked about already. And thirdly, on a related point, it clarifies the privilege. Right now, there is a movement for courts to have a common law privilege out there. And the states that have adopted that have actually said the regulator doesn't get it. Internal, voluntary, self-audits, regulator does not get it. With this, we define the privilege, and we define it in a limited way that gives it to the division. The insurance company gets certainty, and the regulator gets the document. So here we're taking the step, a proactive step with this legislation that sets the parameters, and everybody knows the playing rules. Lastly, I should say self-correction is a far better policy for everybody than regulation by lawsuits. Lawsuits are lengthy, expensive, and correct only that particular wrong. Self-correction delivers a more immediate and comprehensive result. So those are the advantages. We see no downside. I don't know if Mr. Trout's here. He can testify about if there are any. We don't believe there are any because, again, the division actually gets the document. I would like to make one last comment, and that is there is some question about really what advantage will be out there. And to that I say two things. First, the people involved in these decisions are human beings, and they're involved in everyday decisions, and just like we all are in small businesses or everyday life. When they are making decisions as to whether or not to review things or whether they should be candid in a particular document, everybody has that concern about, is it going to be used against me or against the company? That's human nature. This helps do away with that. Secondly, I just want to refer this body again to the writings out there that widely and with unanimity support the doctrine of a self-evaluated privilege. That's basically it. Thank you for your time.
Great. Representative Ledoux?
I was just wondering whether there was any particular impetus for this bill right now. For example, I see in looking at the sponsor's statement that this idea apparently originated back in a Harvard Law Review analysis back in 1983, and it's now 2006. So why now? Was there any particular legal case or anything that made you decide to go with this law now?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, there has been a very, more recent trend to do self-evaluated privileges, both generally for corporations and for insurance companies. The insurance company self-audit really had its start, I think, in 1999. So in the short period of 6 years, there's been, I think, 8 jurisdictions that have adopted this statutorily. I can't cite you the particular case, but I can tell you that what has happened, I mean, there's a lot of lawsuits out there about corporate misdealings, and corporations are encouraged to go out and look at themselves more, but they're concerned about the ramifications of doing that. And so there are quite a few cases out there that address this and the public policy, raising the public policy concerns. But is there a particular case in Alaska? No, there's not.
Representative Ledoux, follow up?
It's actually a new question.
Oh, a new question. Gabrielle Ledoux, Kodiak.
Does this no longer amends the rules of evidence?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, no, it really doesn't, and for two reasons. First of all, when we first had the NCOIL model,
What's the NCOIL model?
The NCOIL model is the model act based by from the National Commission of Insurance Legislators. Okay, and that is one that's modeled on these other states that have this. And that model act actually had a provision where the regulator, the division, didn't automatically get the document. If the insurance company objected to giving the document, there was a court procedure that we had to go to court and issue subpoenas and a process where there'd be a certain time frame for the court to issue the decision as to whether or not it's protected or not. We don't have that anymore. We took that right out because the regulator gets the document up front, no questions asked. So that does away with that. The second part of that is the court rules that possibly may, somebody suggested may be impacted are as follows. And they all say the same thing, whether it's Evidence Rule 402 or Evidence Rule 501, which applies to privileges. Evidence rule is the general rule that privileges may be recognized in court only as provided, and it says, except as otherwise provided by the enactments of the Alaska legislature. And every one of these rules says that. Evidence Rule 402 dealing with evidence. All relevant evidence is admissible, except as otherwise provided by enactments of the Alaska legislature. There is no conflict with that rule. So those are the two reasons why there is no conflict with court rules.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if insurance company was to undertake the self-audit, they got a recommendation and then they decided not to follow that recommendation, decided that wasn't in the company's best interest, that would be inadmissible under this change that we have here.
Representative Crawford, through the chair, if I'm hearing your question right, yes, for example, in a court of law, that would be inadmissible. But
you're saying inadmissible, meaning prohibited from being admissible.
Inadmissible, yes. But don't forget, the regulator always gets that document.
Mm-hmm. And your point is, Chairman Anderson speaking, your point is that in the reason you had the bill sponsored, but for that type of threat, so folks wouldn't do self-audits. These companies wouldn't do it because then there would always be a risk, well, wait, we can analyze your self-audit, And if we find a weakness or something that you didn't follow through by the letter of your audit, then you're in either violation or you've caused a problem, and that's a weakness in a case, and then you could be attacked. And so it's not compelling to do self-audits. If you can be exempted from having to reveal the self-audit, I mean, isn't that the mindset there? Then it helps the consumer, it helps the process, and there's no one harmed from it.
Chairman, so that's correct. That's one of the strongest arguments for the privilege.
Representative Ledoux.
Are you doing self-audits now?
Representative Ledoux, the chair, yes, we are doing self-audits now. We believe the good companies are out there actively trying to do this. Are there things that we'd want to do in addition? Probably. But what this bill does for the companies that are out there doing right now, it defines what can be given to the division, everything. It makes us give to the division. It encourages us to give to the division. So there's those benefits as well.
Representative Ledoux, then Guttenberg.
Okay. I guess my point is that if you're doing self-audits now without this bill, and on the findings on this bill, it talks about that the public's going to benefit by this bill, and you're already doing self-audits, then by this bill, I guess I don't understand how the public really is going to benefit, because you're taking something away that the public would normally be able to get now, and you're doing the self-audits now.
Well, Representative Ledoux, I guess there's 2 points to that. I don't want there to be any confusion that by doing self-audits, we are doing everything we possibly can. And I certainly believe there are some other companies out there that maybe would be encouraged to do more with this provision out there. That's what the writings say. There will be more self-audits, and they will be more candid. That's one of the benefits of it. So, I mean, there's more things to do.
Representative Ledoux?
Right now, the Division of Insurance, if I understand it correctly, can require audits under certain times if they suspect that something may be incorrect. Am I correct about that?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, they can do their own examinations, and I think part of that involves, of course, getting documents and examination materials from us. So, yes.
And the division's here after you speak to answer that, so you might reserve some of those. For Representative
Ledoux. Just a follow-up. So I'm thinking that if there is a case, a situation where you are thinking that something might be wrong, and that you're thinking that the Division of Insurance might require an evaluation, an audit, wouldn't it be smarter for you to do your self-audit first? Under this bill, before the division required you to do something, and if you didn't have this bill, then the public would be able to get the information when the division required the audit, if I'm making any sense.
So is this an obfuscative move
yes.
by the insurance agencies that I'm sponsoring?
Representative Director of the
Say
Chair.
No, please.
Yeah. Therein, I think, goes to the beauty of this actual bill as opposed to some of the other laws in there. The division will always get that. Okay, so if we do the audit, yes, it's going to encourage us to do a self audit in the first place. But the division is still going to get that. And under this bill, if the division looks at it and thinks that our conduct is so egregious, the underlying conduct, or our remedy was not appropriate, the division is free to do whatever it wants to do in its own examination. This does not preclude ever the division's own examination, nor does it in any way immunize us from any penalty, any sanction, any examination there is. So, yes, the insurance company would be foolish if they thought an audit is, you know, there's a problem not to do this. But does it give them any protection? Only the protection of going to the division and saying, we beg for mercy, so to speak. But it does not preclude any sanctions by the division at all.
Okay. Okay, Representative Ledoux.
As far as the public is concerned, the public wouldn't be able to get the the information. Whereas if the insurance company required the audit, then the public would be able to get that information.
Rep. Somebody, I there is an exception in the privilege. If it's done for fraudulent reasons, then it doesn't apply. It truly has to be for making sure you're complying with something. And that's the only answer I have to that.
And I'll just follow up. I mean, this isn't an anomaly that we're promoting here. I presume 8 other states did it because it was in the best interest of consumer protection. I assume that's what was in the minutes.
Yes.
If you were to speak on the other states, not specifically, but in general, isn't it based on what we wrote in the sponsor statement, that it's for consumer protection and it's for efficiencies and kind of innovation for the state farms and all states? Allstate, I had Josh call out my contact with Allstate, who can't call in, Devery Prince, but he endorses the bill. I mean, because again, they think that it enhances their business and it helps the consumer.
Yeah. Chairman, if I may add that, it's correct. If I may add that, if you go back to the writings, it is a consumer protection bill, because the whole concept is these companies are out there doing self-regulation and self-correction that they otherwise might not do. So, thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Representative Guttenberg, then Rokeberg.
Thank you. A request to the chair and then a couple of questions. I would like to see a side-by-side of the INCOL recommendations and what this bill does.
Okay.
Because many times we see references a model plan and it's done by other states, and there's certain things left out that could have considerable impact, the difference between what we're trying to do.
Representative Guttenberg, I'll make sure Heath works with Sheldon and other folks advocating the bill, and we'll get a matrix done for you to review before the bill is brought up again.
So a self-audit is done. This bill passes. A self-audit is done. The division doesn't like some of the what the audit says, recommends changes. The entity that did the self-audit, the company that did the self-audit, doesn't make the changes. Now, the division now has the information and are able to do their own work. They can't use the work product because it's not admissible. It's not discoverable. But what happens if they do the work to create the same audit and get the same results and take it to whatever the authority is after this? And the company says, well, you can't use that because you had that information already and you just repeated it, even though it's with an independent work product. Wouldn't that preclude it from being public?
No. Representative Guttenberg, and the answer is no, and this bill clearly states that with the exact language. The only thing that is protected is our mental process, our evaluation of it. All the underlying data that we relied on, all the claims files or whatever we looked at, all the records, is still fair game. And the fact that we used that information for our own evaluation doesn't protect that pre-existing material whatsoever. So when the division decides they don't like what we did and we can't work out something out, and they want to do their own examination, everything is fair game. All that same stuff we looked at is fair game, and it becomes public record. I shouldn't even say that, because the underlying information is not even part of this privilege. It's the document and the mental process of, okay, we've looked at these files, here's our evaluation, we messed up, and here's our fix or non-fix. That's the protection, not the pre-existing stuff.
So that audit is done, the director has gone through that process with you, and a few years later down the road there's another audit that says, instead of using it to expand consumer protection, not you, but your comment, it's been used the other way. There's a comparison between two self audits that show the company's going in the wrong direction as far as consumer protection goes. The public, the policyholder, has no right to that, to those audits. The comparison between those audits. Would the comparison be public if the divisions showed the difference between two results of the policies at two different times?
Representative Governor, are you talking about audits by the division or audits by the insurance company, or both?
Both. Let's just say the insurance company did an audit that said 20% of people are being paid late, and the division says make that 15%. 2 years later, an audit comes back that says, well, it's now 30 instead of 15. Is that product, is that the difference between those audits a product? I'm trying to find out because this does not seem to be consumer friendly to me. You know, we hear a lot of things in here that, you know, purport to be, and you know, we just have to ask these questions because I'm not seeing it.
Okay. And to interject, when you answer the question, again, as a sponsor, I respect your questions, but why add in why eight other states passed the law? Because that was one thing I asked you before I said I'd sponsor it, is right. Are we the first state to do this, or are we in the midst of a domino effect of states modernizing their insurance industry?
Right. Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, to answer your question, I think the first assessment is finding that there are, 20% not paid timely. Mm-hmm. Okay. The statistics, the data, the claims files that came up with that analysis are fair game for anybody at any time. This doesn't change that at all. Okay. What this does, and what these other eight states have done, and the intent of this is to encourage the insurer to take that data and look at it and say, are we doing this right? And if 20% is a bad standard, then to come up with that assessment that otherwise would not have been done and say, how are we going to fix that? And that's protected. Now, if the division on its own decides to do its own assessment, it doesn't have anything to do with the original self-evaluative document or evaluation from the division. What the division does on its own has nothing to do with this privilege. I don't know if I answered that fully for you or not.
Move on.
Representative Roquefort, then, and then Representative Lynn.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Winter, I'm still trying to wrap my arms around this. It seems to me that correct me if I'm wrong, what you're trying to do here is expose a problem and develop a remedy that minimizes the sanctions and still benefits the public as a policy call here. In other words, you want to blow the whistle on yourself without having to and go in and negotiate perhaps with the Division of Insurance to ameliorate the problem. I mean, that seems to be the practical.
Representative Roper, I think that's the...
why are you doing this?
Well, you're doing it, one, to find the problem in the first place.
Right.
Okay, and secondly, yes, you want to be able to go to the division and say, here it is, and negotiate with them. Keeping in mind that if you can't, if they're not happy with your remedy, you've tipped them off of the problem.
But the bill says the report you give them is privileged, but not the raw data. So if the division wants to go back and investigate on their own, they can do so.
Correct.
Just so you have...
And the bill actually
in the shredder.
And the bill actually says that.
Okay, and then, but Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up here, I'm trying to get make a distinction here. Maybe Representative Guttenberg has asked for a side-by-side between the bill and NCOIL, but we might want to include a column that says what's the current status. Because you say you do this now, which I assume you would as a matter of efficiency and understanding your own procedures and their efficacy, but I just really took a cursory glance here, but what authorizes you to do this? I mean, you can do it anyway, but why? And you do it now, but you don't have to turn it over to the Division of Insurance. Now, the bill doesn't require you to turn it over to the Division of Insurance either, does it? If you do it on it?
Representative Roquefort, whether or not we have to turn over the Division of Insurance under, we're talking about a self-evaluative privilege.
And in the bill.
Okay. Currently, there is no statute. Right. Currently, there is no Alaska case law addressing that. Other states have adopted a judicial doctrine of self-evaluative privilege. Whether or not Alaska would do that, I don't know. One of the reasons for this bill is it clears that up. There is a privilege, and it's limited in Alaska.
But currently, just to follow up kind of what Representative Ledoux was trying to get at, I think, was that you can undertake these self-audits, but there's no legal or required rationale for turning it over to the division. But under the bill, even under the bill, you're not required to do that, are you?
Representative Ogburn, no, it doesn't. The intent of the bill is that if the division asks, it shall get. This does not if to the extent there's any sort of
What triggers your evaluation is what I'm getting at. Is it on your own, the corporate volition to do this?
Exactly.
And but therefore, the conclusions of which, do you have a duty to turn them over to division, or do you can we withhold them at your discretion?
Under this bill, we cannot withhold them.
So you're mandated under the bill to turn them over. Currently, you don't have to turn them over.
Well, that's true. When you say turn them over, do we produce them and then turn them to the division? It'll get to the division in one of two ways. One, we say we need to take this to the division and turn ourselves in voluntarily. Or two, the division asks and we have to give.
Hmm. But but there's no statutory requirement to disclose or not to disclose now, but there would be under the bill.
No, there is in statutes right now. There are many statutes out there that says the division asks and we shall give.
No, but they're not asking. You're doing a self-evaluation.
I'm sorry, what?
This is a self-evaluation, not one motivated by the division's request, I would assume. Naturally, if they request some information, you have to comply. But the whole idea between a self-audit is one that is started because of your own internal policy.
What I think we need to do is do that matrix to explain, okay. And maybe we can even parallel it to the other states, because, again, I think that's instructive to see why did they do this. There must have been a rationale of eight states' legislatures.
Three columns is enough.
We will. We'll get it for you. Representative Lynn, then Representative Ledoux, then we'll go to the two testifiers, and then Division of Insurance, and then hold the bill.
All right. On the last point that was made here, apparently you do this audit or self-evaluation, but it doesn't automatically go to the Division of Insurance. They may not even know that you did it, so they wouldn't ask for something if they didn't know you did it. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, this does not provide that anything we do, we automatically will ship to the Division of Insurance. I'm sure there's many things they don't want to have that we do.
And I guess we keep talking about these eight states that have done this bill. There are 42 other states out there, which includes Alaska. Have any of the other 42 states looked at this type of legislation and said, we don't want to do it, and this is why we don't want to do it? We keep talking about eight have done it, but 42 have not. Why?
Well, Representative, I don't think it's been introduced in 42 other states. Well, I can probably get that information for you. I'm sure I can.
And just do you know, through the chair, so there may have been some states out there who looked at similar legislation and said, we don't want to do this because?
Well, I'll speak to that. We'll find out and do an assessment of what other states have had introductory language that didn't pass. And then I would also caveat, there's a lot of good bills that you have introductory language. You and I have some that don't pass, but it doesn't mean they're not meritorious. So, Representative Ledoux?
I was getting at the same question that Representative Lynn was getting at.
So. Okay, great. Okay, then we're good with you for now, because like I've said, we'll hold the bill. We'll go to Michael Schneider, then Donna McCready, and then Division of Insurance.
May it please the chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schneider. I'm an attorney in Anchorage where I have practiced since 1975. I'm adamantly opposed to the bill. I'll make just a couple of points today. One of the speakers spoke about the self-assessment privilege already recognized in Alaska law, and I'd like the committee to consider carefully where it is recognized. In environmental matters and in matters related to the provision of health care. Certainly, it could be argued. It is the case that you literally have people's lives and futures in the balance, and often in environmental matters and in terms of hospital and medical review. So that here we're talking about money, and we're talking about insurance industry money. And with precious few exceptions, the insurance industry is not centered in this state. The insurance industry, according to Attorney General of New York Elliot Spitzer's testimony to some committee in the Senate not long ago, in a recent year, I can't remember, I want to tell you it's 2003, premium income. And by the way, the industry never doesn't make its money on premiums. It makes it on its reserves. But premium income for the insurance industry in the U.S. amounted to 10% of the gross domestic product. I bring this up only to say that the idea that the insurance industry is somehow cowed by the existing Alaska Fair Claims Settlement Practices Act, that it is somehow controlled, manipulated, or put off its intended course by the Alaska Division of Insurance as it is currently manned and staffed, is a notion completely devoid of merit. I would like the members of the committee, I'm going to mention this one other area and await your questions if you have any. But a couple things. First of all, the narrow definition accounted by the last speaker that this privilege applies only to the thoughts, the evaluative process, and the piece of paper that comes out of that is something, and I must confess, I have not seen version Y. I've only seen version G as in Gulf. But that's not anything I see expressed in this document. You could sweep a bunch of sins into something called a self-evaluative insurance audit and completely protect that information from view, at least as this bill is currently written. Secondly, think about this. You got a jury listening to evidence put on by an insurance company, and the evidence is from their experts that having reviewed all these files and looked at the big picture, nothing was done wrong to plaintiff Citizen Jones. Nothing was done wrong. Our policies are good. Our procedures are good. We don't lie, cheat, steal. We salute the flag. We're out of the other side of their corporate mouth. They've developed a document that says Citizen Jones got hosed. So, in my view, folks, this bill promotes perjury, and you're going to see it from some carriers as a consequence of this kind of protective legislation. I think that while there are individuals, many of us as individuals buy insurance, all the larger corporate interests in the state, almost all of them buy insurance or are insured in some manner or other. So, the gift that this legislation brings to the industry is at the expense, I would suggest, of all of your constituents, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, whether you like big outfits, little outfits, or regular people, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. There is no need to give the richest and powerful game and most rich and powerful game in town more protection from the law. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, any questions for Mr. Schneider? Seeing none, we'll go next to Donna McCready. Donna, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman Anderson, this is Donna McCready. I'm testifying on behalf of myself and also the Alaska Action Trust. I'm going to keep my comments very brief, and mainly because what I want to urge the committee to do is to hold this bill in committee until there's time to really analyze it. I had a copy of the G version, as did Mr. Schneider, and I was just handed the Y version, and frankly, I haven't had a chance to review it. This is complex litigation. I think there's a lot of downstream consequences that are going to come of it, and I really think the committee needs to take the time to properly analyze it. As I read at least the last version, and what I've heard here in terms of the questions of the legislators and what Mr. Winters has said is I have a grave concern about this bill not being for consumer protection. In fact, I think it's going to hurt consumers. But it also does hurt, I would expect it to hurt the business community as well. Businesses are insured, individuals are insured, and now as I see it, the insurance industry is asking to be given a privilege that I think as just stated, only doctors and perhaps folks doing environmental evaluations are given, and there's no reason to do this. They're already doing audits because they're in business. Any business is going to be doing a self-audit, as I think Representative Ledoux had asked and pointed out. So it's not like they're not doing the audits. They're doing them. It's just that the effect of this legislation is is we don't get those audits. And I agree with what Mr. Schneider was saying. I'm concerned about this privilege, even though it's being presented as a very narrow privilege. I see it being, and even if the legislation says what Mr. Winters says it says, I have a concern that it would be interpreted by the insurance industry as much broader than is being represented here today. And I think that that's also kind of a human factors analysis that goes into play, that the insurance industry is going to view this as a broader privilege. And I want to know who is, in fact, going to be enforcing the privilege. Who, in fact, is going to be able to say whether or not the insurance industry is only protecting documents as stated by this proposed legislation that, again, is presented by Mr. Winters. And I'm very concerned about that. I would like very much for the committee to hold this in committee until we have a chance to properly, until the committee members have a chance to properly analyze it. I'd like to have a chance to present some authority counter to what I heard today, that this sort of privilege has been, I guess, encouraged by unanimously by authorities that are out there that have considered it. I suspect that that is not the case, and I'd like to have a chance to communicate with committee members and bring to their attention some contrary authority. So that being said, I appreciate your taking my testimony today.
Thank you. Any questions for Donna, Representative Roakberg?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Creedy,
yes.
I couldn't hear the name of your organization. And
yes, well, first I'm here on behalf of myself because I'm a citizen of this state. I'm also a business owner. I'm a lawyer. And I'm also with the Alaska Action Trust.
And could you explain to the committee what that trust
Absolutely.
Is?
We're a group of plaintiff's attorneys and also criminal defense attorneys. And we like to watch legislation that we think are going to hurt consumers in the state.
Never heard of them before, but it's good to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Division of Insurance last, and then we'll adjourn and try to supplement that information requested.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeffrey Trout. I am Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance. When I'd walked over, I just thought I'd be here and answer questions, but that chance, I realized.
Yeah.
So let me, if I could talk just a little bit about the bill. The bill as it originally came, I had some problems with it. One is it wasn't really clear that the Division of Insurance would be entitled to a self-evaluative audit. And number two, the provisions that would have excluded it from a criminal trial, which I didn't think, you know, if we were going to bring a criminal action, I wouldn't want to have that kind of admission kept out of court. You know, I don't have it. If I email you and say I cheated on my taxes, I don't have it. So I don't see why the insurance company should have it either. I've faced this issue before in the product safety area. In a sort of prior incarnation, I would work for the Consumer Product Safety Commission in Washington, D.C. And in the product safety area, there are a group of people who believe that a similar thing, a self-evaluative audit, ought to be excluded from discovery in civil cases, as well as from FOIA requests or if we get them, that kind of thing. For the most part, courts have rejected it on the federal level, rejected the argument. And I notice, and one of the reasons I supported it is because I spent a lot of time talking with industry, talking about problems they had. And in the absence of being able to look at facts rather objectively without fear of what the consequences are going to be, you do tend to get, I think it's impossible to be a human being and not be a little influenced by that. And I saw that as I talked with industry. I mean, there's 80,000 dryer fires in the United States per year. They're all caused by consumer, they're all caused by consumer abuse. And there's that kind of thing. And it can also stifle, in the product safety area, it can stifle innovation because you tend to not want to make an improvement because then it's going to make it look like your problem with your product was defective to begin with. So I think you want to create an environment where people who work for a company can candidly evaluate what they do. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be consequences when things are wrong. I have to be frank with you. I'm less persuaded in the insurance agency than in the product safety area that it's all that necessary, because, you know, as a previous testifier suggested, there's, you know, nobody's going to die as a result, as a result of this. But could service be improved? I think that's a distinct possibility. Would insurance companies be more likely to be able to ferret out wrongdoing within their own company if they could candidly look at issues? Possibly. And if that's the case, then this is good consumer litigation. I mean, and you know, I'll admit to you, I come from a bias that I look for what's the best for the consumer in evaluating things like this. So, you know, I guess it's sort of a qualified support that I'm giving it. As I see the bill, it basically keeps one document, which, you know, may be a large document. It may have attachments that have been generated as part of an audit. But it basically keeps one document out of court and out of discovery. Neither prevents the underlying facts are not privileged. Any other document is not privileged. What I see it doing is basically means the Division of Insurance, we can't hoist them on their own petard. We can't take their audit, you know, stab them in the gut with it, and say here's a civil penalty. But that doesn't mean we can't look at it and say, this is some pretty bad conduct. We better get a petard and hoist them on it. There's nothing that prevents us from taking action on that. And nor does it, you know, I mean, it would keep, I would think, what may be at times a pretty lucrative admission out of a civil case. And I can understand why the plaintiff's lawyers would want that admission, but it wouldn't prevent the facts that underlay that admission.
Lying.
Yeah, sorry.
Sounds like an ABBA song.
I should have paid more attention in English class. I'm sorry, but beyond that, I don't see that it. That it interferes. It certainly doesn't interfere. I don't think it interferes with what we do. I mean, it's very important to me that we at the Division of Insurance have access to those kinds of documents. I mean, and that we be able to use those documents in a subsequent civil or administrative action, or use it as a basis for it. And so having sort of being a bit long-winded about it, I apologize, but I'll be happy to answer any questions.
No, I appreciate that. Correct. And again, we're going to bring the bill back. Representative Lyndon Cott.
I guess you said a very interesting thing. I guess the bottom line is this a good bill for consumers, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I think on balance it is more likely than not good for consumers. Although I would like to reserve the right to come back to you in 2 years and say this has been terrible.
Sure.
If we believe that it's been bad for consumers, we'll come tell you.
Good. Representative Cott, then Ledoux.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chout, we got two components here dealing. We got the audit itself, the insurance compliance audit. And then we have the insurance compliance audit documents. The audit is the makeup the overall umbrella of the documents, I would assume, going back to my military days. Where in the bill would you gain the information to give you additional information and potential authority that requires the insurer E to then submit that audit to you?
Mm-hmm.
Because in the bill it says the insurer may voluntarily. So even if you requested it, because of the voluntary nature of that, I mean, I'm assuming I'm just giving you the worst case scenario, because I think there's another underlying theme here, but how would you then get that if they don't report it to you?
through the chair, Representative Scott, if I understand your question correctly, it's sort of twofold. One is, how are you even going to know this exists, and what about the attachments? Are they keeping attachments out? Do I understand it correctly? Okay. As far as how I know it exists, I don't think we wouldn't necessarily always know that a document exists, although I would expect that when we went to do a financial or a market conduct exam on anybody, one of the first questions out of the auditor's mouth would be, have you done any self-evaluative audits? And presumably we would find out as a result of that. That would, from an investigator's or an examiner's point of view, that actually getting that document would probably save a lot of work. With respect to the attachments, as I understand the bill, any attachment that exists outside of this audit would be fair game. I understand why people might be concerned that, say, photographs or graphs or something like that might be, some things might be created in the creation of the audit that perhaps ought to be used. I can see where you might not want to exclude photographs, for example, because it documents a moment in time that may not come back. But having said that, if the bill goes through as it is, any photograph that already exists is going to be subject to our process. We can get it, and it wouldn't be excluded. While I can see it would be sensible. It may be, you may want to look at it and ask, well, documents created course of the audit, whether or not those ought to be not subject to a privilege. I don't think it would have. I think it would affect the under. You could do that without affecting the underlying thing that you want to accomplish, in the sense of, which is really basically removing what's probably admissions from discovery or admissibility.
Okay. Representative Ledoux Guttenberg, and then we'll adjourn.
I was just going to wonder, if you accept the argument that people aren't absolutely candid when they could conceivably get in trouble for it, then the fact that these internal review documents would be available to the division, wouldn't that kind of decimate the entire analysis there? I mean, they might not be available to the plaintiff's lawyer, but they'd still be available to the division.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a valid point. That's a valid point, and I don't argue with you on that. I practice law. I know you have. I believe you have too for a long time, and it is remarkable how people's memories and their conclusions tend to support what's in their interest. I don't know that it's sort of a problem. I don't think you can solve. I don't think this bill would solve that problem. And frankly, I wouldn't know. The only way you can really solve that problem is to say it doesn't, is to create a privilege that keeps it away from everybody. And I think you don't want to do that. You got to balance it.
And so, since this bill doesn't solve that problem, and that problem is a good portion of the reason for the bill, why do the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. That's a valid question. As I told you, I'm not, you know, enthusiastically sold on the idea, but I think it's a balance. And you know, more than likely than not, on balance, you'll get better compliance with that bill. And yes, you are, you know, you're not going to remove somebody's incentive to create a document thinking about what the Division of Insurance is going to think about it. That's true, but I'd probably say in all candor, they're probably a lot more worried about plaintiff's attorneys than they are us, because you know we generally don't go and you know we don't do you know $4 million judgments for coffee beans spilled. So you know that it's probably less of an incentive.
But the kind of things that are involved in these cases aren't actually civil personal injury claims involving coffee being spilled. They tend to more be about when insurance companies haven't properly serviced their own assureds, correct?
I used a bad analogy and you've called me out on it.
But you also testified that you believe that it's more in benefit of the consumer than not, based on your background as a consumer advocate in D.C. and then also as Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance. And with your background, you're stating that in all likelihood, on the balance, it's more for the consumer because of the idea that it's regulating and self-auditing the company, so it's bettering itself.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
The way I read this on page 4, section F, if this passes, you've got the attorney-client privilege. You're never going to be able to come back here and talk to us about how this doesn't work. And that covers work product, remedial measure, I mean, the whole thing. I don't know if any place else in the state that we have a lawyer-inquired attorney-client privilege with an entity out there. But that's it. You're never going to be able to talk to us.
I think that's inaccurate based on expressions from the bat.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. I think what they're talking about is it doesn't affect what's existing. Things that are there are things that are arguably covered by the attorney-client privilege that we're not going to get, that we're not likely to get anyway. I mean, I don't know that this would affect it. As I understand it, it's simply saying that doctrine doesn't change as a result of this.
Yeah, what I like is
and if I'm wrong, I'll be happily come back and see if I'm wrong.
And Representative Lynn asking about, hey, 42 other states, why haven't they adopted? Have there been measures? Have they been rejected or not? Ledoux agreed with that, and then Representative Guttenberg has talked about evidentiary. Mm-hmm. Is it all closed off? Representative Ledoux, in a broader sense, said, what based on some of the testimony, what is there a need? Will it benefit versus be a detriment? And I think that's not for you to answer. It's for the interested parties, and we'll have some matrices and analysis of other states for the next meeting. Wrap up, Representative McCott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Trout, I would assume that the division does not want to see every one of these self-induced audits.
Through the chair, Representative Cott, that's probably true. Having stated that, I'll admit I'm answering the question in complete ignorance of how many every insurance company does per year. I mean, if they do three, I want to see them.
I'm sure, but if would the division be interested in seeing those audits in which there was a major discrepancy discovered that detrimentally affected the insuree?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely, and again, and if I should also state if it raises a sufficient so rises to a certain level, it may be something we want to take administrative action on.
But you personally like the bill, and we're eager to come to testify, correct? He said yes for adjournment.